This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Now please help me welcome Charles Kennell. Charlie Kennell is also one of the former directors of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he is currently a distinguished professor emeritus here at Scripps and a research professor with interests that include global environmental change, space science, science policy, and astrophysics. Charlie is going to introduce our speaker, Lord Rees.
A lot of people have scientific accomplishments that get them to the threshold of the Nirenberg Prize, but the prize is given for science in the public interest. It's not enough to do the good science, it's very important to communicate it. And here, amongst his generation, the present generation of astrophysicists, he has no peer. He has published quite a number of books that written for the general audience, but do not speak down to the general audience. And so I believe that Martin is fully in the tradition of America's greatest science communicator, Carl Sagan, and I think it's fair to state that the work that Martin has communicated has a deeper and more profound intellectual content. And for that, I am myself deeply appreciative. Each of us, as we grow up in science, we all have heroes and mentors and exemplars and peers, people that whose lives and thoughts are influencing our own. And I have my own pantheon of scientists with whom I've worked, and I have to tell you that Martin sits at the right hand of Jupiter in my my pantheon. But in thinking about his intellectual development, it occurred to me that there were two individuals, or maybe, that have had a profound influence on and shaping the way Martin thinks and the way he feels. The first we've both spoken to before, there was the young Albert Einstein. The Albert Einstein that thought about deeply about the nature of space and time, and in fact invented a mathematical way and a conceptual way of connecting the earliest moments of the universe with its deep future. And this spread of time as has been always, I believe, in Martin's mind. But then, on the right, there's the older Einstein. Einstein, the humanist, who spoke of the primacy of human values and is one of the first to speak out on the topic of existential risk. But in the middle, there's Darwin. Why is he there? Well, you could say they both went to the same school, the Shrewsbury School, and in fact, this ancient school counts the two of them as their most important graduates. So what influence did this have? I know for myself that watching I have the portrait of Darwin looking down at me at all times, and he says, "Did you think deeply enough today?" So that was some influence, of course, but I think it was much deeper than that, because Darwin understood geological and astronomical time and the way that the complex life that we see today has been generated as a natural consequence of the existence of the universe. And so it must be that Darwin, that example, has played a big role in your thinking. And I, too, looked through the internet, and I found something wonderful that you said that I think says it all. We need to broaden our sympathies, both in space and time, and perceive ourselves as part of a long heritage and stewards for an immense future. So please welcome our steward of our future.
Professor Lennon, members of the Nuremberg family, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure and privilege to be here. And I'd like to add a special welcome to the 25 or so alumni of Cambridge University who very kindly come along to a to stop me feeling too much of an alien in this country. So welcome. It is indeed an honour to be here, because the roll call of the previous lecturers is a very eminent one, and it's also daunting because for everything I'm going to say, there are bigger experts on it somewhere in the audience. But like Bill Nuremberg himself, I'm an evangelist for new technology. We need more, not less. But like many of us, I'm anxious that it's advancing so fast that we may not properly cope with it, and we may have a bumpy ride through this century. And I'm going to start with a cosmic vignette. For nearly 50 years, this image has been iconic among environmentalists. But suppose there were some aliens out there who'd been watching our planet, not for 50 years, but for its entire 4.5 billion years. What would they have seen? Over nearly all that immense time, Earth's appearance would have altered very slowly. The continents drifted, the ice cover waxed and waned, successive species emerged, evolved, and became extinct. But in just a tiny sliver of the Earth's history, the last 1 millionth part, a few thousand years, the patterns of vegetation started to alter much faster. This signaled the start of agriculture, and the pace of change accelerated as human populations rose. The world entered a new geological era, the Anthropocene. Then there were other changes, even faster. Within just 50 years, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere began to rise anomalously fast. And something else unprecedented happening. Rockets launched from the planet's surface escaped the biosphere completely. Some were propelled into orbits around the Earth, some journeyed to the moon and planets. Well, the hypothetical aliens would have known that the Earth would face doom in a few billion years when the sun flares up and dies. But could they have predicted this sudden fever halfway through its lifetime? These human-induced alterations seemingly happening at runaway speed. Well, if they continued to keep watch, what might these aliens witness in the next 100 years? Will a final spasm be followed by silence? Or will the planet's ecology stabilize? And will an armada of rockets launched from the Earth spawn new oases of life elsewhere? Well, these are topics which I hope to address this evening, raising questions, of course, rather than offering answers. A few years ago, I met a well-known Indian tycoon. He knew I was the Astronomer Royal, and he asked, "Do you do the Queen's horoscopes?" And I responded with a straight face, "Well, if she wanted one, she'd ask me." And he then looked very serious and seemed eager to hear my predictions. I told him that stocks would fluctuate, there'd be trouble in the Middle East and other insightful things, and he listened very solemnly. But I then came clean. I said I was just an astronomer. And he then lost all interest in my predictions. And rightly so, because scientists are rotten forecasters, almost as bad as economists. Indeed, in the 1950s, an earlier Astronomer Royal said that space travel was utter bilge. But even with a cloudy crystal ball, there are some things we can predict. It's almost inevitable that by mid-century, the world will be more crowded and our collective footprint will be heavier. So a word about that. World population, we know it's been increasing over the centuries. It's increasing, and it's reached about 6 billion in the year 2000, and it's going to increase further. It's about 7 billion today, but the growth is slowing. Nonetheless, the world population is forecast to increase to about 9 billion by mid-century. And the reason for that is that most people in the developing world are young. This contrasts the age histogram of people in a part of Africa and in Europe. And what's going to happen is that even if the birth rate doesn't increase, then the left-hand side will become like the right-hand side, because the young people in Africa and elsewhere will have their children, they grow old, and they live for much longer than their predecessors. And that's why the population rise will bring us up to about 9 billion by mid-century. But the other reason why we expect growth is that the demographic transition hasn't yet reached parts of India and sub-Saharan Africa. Population is still growing. That's illustrated by this distorted map. This shows how the world population increased in the last 25 years in different areas. The growth is in India and in Africa. And we can predict that growth continuing. And indeed, by 2050, 70% of the world will be living in cities. And even by 2030, Lagos, Sao Paulo and Delhi will have populations of more than 30 million each. And I think to prevent these megacities becoming turbulent dystopias will surely be a major challenge for governments. Population growth seems currently rather under-discussed. And that's maybe because doom-laden predictions in the 1970s by the Club of Rome, Paul Ehrlich and others have proved off the mark, and because it's deemed by some a taboo subject, tainted by association with eugenics in the 20s and 30s, with Indian policies under Indira Gandhi, and more recently with China's hardline one-child policy. But we're going to have 9 billion people by mid-century. Can they be fed? I think the answer is, in principle, yes. Improved agriculture, low-till, water-conserving, and perhaps involving GM crops, together with better engineering to reduce waste and improve irrigation, could sustainably feed 9 billion by mid-centuries. Whether it will happen, of course, depends on governance and other things, but there's no technical impediment to that. There need to be some lifestyle changes, of course. The world can't sustain even its present population if everyone lives like we do today, using as much energy as we do and eating as much beef as we do. There'll have to be some changes. Trends beyond 2050 are harder to predict because they'll depend on what people now in their teens and 20s decide about the number and spacing of their children. Enhanced education and empowerment of women, surely a benign priority in any case, could reduce fertility rates where they're now highest. But will this happen? In fact, there are some new UN projections which show how imponderable what happens in Africa is. Because if the demographic transition doesn't happen in Africa, then Africa's population could double again between 2050 and 2100 to 4 billion, thereby raising the global population to 11 billion. And on that projection, Nigeria alone would have a population similar to Europe and the United States combined, and almost half the world's children would be in Africa. So that's an extreme projection leading to 11 billion. We must surely hope that the demographic transition does occur and that the population doesn't get much above 9 billion, because the higher it becomes, the greater will be all pressure on resources, especially if the developing world narrows its gap with the developed world in its per capita consumption. And, of course, the higher the population of Africa becomes, the harder it will be for that continent to escape the poverty trap. Moreover, if humanity's collective impact on nature pushes too hard against what Johan Rockström calls planetary boundaries, then the resultant ecological shock could irreversibly impoverish our biosphere. Extinction rates are rising. We're destroying the book of life before we've read it. And biodiversity is, of course, a crucial component of human well-being. We're clearly harmed if fish stocks dwindle to extinction. We're clearly harmed also if there are plants in the rainforest whose gene pool might be useful to us, and they're extinguished. But for many environmentalists, these instrumental and anthropocentric arguments aren't the most compelling ones. For them, preserving the richness of our biosphere has value in its own right, over and above what it means to us humans. And to quote the great ecologist E.O. Wilson, I quote, "Mass extinction is the sin that future generations will least forgive us for." The world is getting more crowded, we can predict that, and as a second firm prediction we can make, it'll gradually get warmer. Now, in contrast to population issues, climate change is certainly not under-discussed, and many of its greatest experts are here. And, of course, the key datum comes from here, the famous Keeling curve, showing how the concentration of CO2 in the air is rising, mainly due to the burning of fossil fuels. And CO2, straightforwardly, is a greenhouse gas, but it's still unclear how much its effect is amplified by associated changes in water vapour and clouds, and that's why the fifth IPCC report has a spread of predictions. But there are two messages that, despite the uncertainty, most would agree on. One, regional disruptions to weather patterns within the next decade or two will aggravate pressure on food and water and engender migration. Secondly, under business as usual, we can't rule out, later in the century, tipping points, really catastrophic warming, triggering long-term trends like the melting of Greenland's ice cap. But I want to make a point that I think underappreciated, which is that even people who accept both those statements, some problems in the coming decades, possible catastrophe a century from now, even people who agree on both of those, diverge very much in their policy recipes. And those differences stem less from differences in the science than from differences in the economics and in the ethics. In particular, in how much obligation we should feel towards future generations. Economists who apply a standard discount rate, as for instance Bjørn Lomborg and his Copenhagen Consensus of economists do, they're in effect writing off what happens beyond 2050. So unsurprisingly, they rather downplay the priority of addressing climate change in comparison with shorter-term efforts to help the world's poor. But if, on the other hand, you care about those who will live into the 22nd century and beyond, then, as other economists like Stern and Weizmann argue, you deem it worth paying an insurance premium now to protect those generations against worst-case scenarios. So even those who agree that there's a significant risk of climate catastrophe a century hence will differ in how urgently they advocate action today. Their assessment will depend on expectations of future growth and optimism about technological fixes. But above all, it depends on an ethical issue. In optimizing people's life chances, should we discriminate on grounds of date of birth? As a parenthesis, I'd note that there is one policy context when essentially zero discount rate is applied. That's to radioactive waste disposal, where people talk with a straight face about whether the depository is safe for 10,000 years. And this is somewhat ironic when in most countries we can't plan the rest of energy policy even 30 years ahead. As regards climate catastrophes, consider this analogy. Suppose astronomers had tracked an asteroid and calculated that it would hit the Earth in, say, 2080, 65 years from now. Not with certainty, but with 10% probability. Would we relax, saying it's a problem that can be set on one side for 50 years? People will then be richer, and it may turn out that it's going to miss the Earth anyway. I don't think we would. I think there'd be a consensus that we should start straight away and do our damnedest to find ways to deflect it or mitigate its effect. So, what will actually happen in climate policy? The pledges made at the Paris conference are a positive step, a step towards limiting future annual emissions of CO2 so that the cumulative concentration in the atmosphere doesn't put us above an expected 2-degree temperature rise. But even if these pledges are honoured, CO2 concentrations will still rise steadily throughout the next 20 years before they turn around. What is crucial is bending the curve, to use the title of a really excellent proposal put forward by this university. But 20 years from now, we will know with far more confidence from a longer time base of data and from much better theoretical modelling just how strong the feedback from water vapour and clouds actually is. We will have a longer time base to see how fast the temperature is actually rising, because that's still uncertain. If the so-called climate sensitivity is low, then perhaps we can relax a bit. But if it's large, and it's already clear 20 years from now that climate consequently seems on an irreversible trajectory into dangerous territory, and if we haven't already taken steps to turn the curve over, then there'll be pressure, I think, for panic measures. And these would involve a plan B, which is being fatalistic about continuing dependence on fossil fuels, but combating its effects by either massive investment in carbon capture and storage, or else by geoengineering. And there are many kinds of geoengineering, the best known is the idea of putting aerosols in the upper atmosphere, in the stratosphere, to cool the world's climate. This has been discussed, and what is scary about it is that it might be within the resources of a single nation, or even a single corporation. And this could cause unintended side effects. Moreover, the warming would return with a vengeance if the countermeasures were ever discontinued. And the other deleterious consequences of rising CO2, especially those on ocean acidification, would be unchecked. So geoengineering would seem feasible, but it would be a political nightmare. Not all nations would want to adjust the thermostat the same way. And very elaborate climate modelling would be needed in order to calculate the regional impact of any artificial intervention. The only beneficiaries would be the lawyers. They'd have a bonanza if nations could litigate over bad weather. I personally think it's prudent to explore geoengineering techniques, at least enough to clarify which options make sense and perhaps damp down undue optimism about a technical quick fix for our climate. Many still hope that our civilization can segue smoothly towards a low-carbon economy. But politicians won't gain much resonance if they advocate a bare-bones approach that entails unwelcome lifestyle changes, especially if the compensating benefits are far away in space and decades in the future. But there are, I think, three important measures that could mitigate climate change and cause the curve to bend over, which are politically realistic. First, all countries could improve energy efficiency, insulate buildings better, and so forth, and thereby actually save money. That's a win-win situation. Second, there's a recommendation specially advocated by the distinguished experts here in La Jolla. We could target cuts to methane, black carbon, and CFC emissions. These are subsidiary contributors to long-term warming, but unlike CO2, they cause local pollution too, in Chinese cities, for instance, and there's a strong incentive to reduce them, and they can have a significant impact on the amount of warming in the next 20 years. But third, nations should expand R&D into all forms of low-carbon energy generation. Renewables, fourth-generation nuclear, fusion and the rest, and into other technologies where parallel progress is crucial, especially storage, batteries, compressed air, pumped storage, flywheels, etc., and smart grids, all those things. That's why an encouraging outcome of Paris was an initiative called Mission Innovation. It was launched by President Obama and the Indian Prime Minister Modi. It was endorsed by the G7 nations, plus India, China, and 11 others. It's hoped that they will pledge to double their publicly funded R&D into clean energy by 2020 and to coordinate efforts. And it's been a parallel pledge by Bill Gates and other philanthropists. This target is actually a modest one, because presently only about 2% of publicly funded R&D is devoted to these challenges. And why shouldn't that percentage rise to be more comparable with medical research and defence research? The faster these clean technologies advance, the sooner will they become affordable to developing countries, where more generating capacity will be needed and where they would otherwise have a strong incentive to build coal-fired power stations. It would be hard to think of a more inspiring challenge for young engineers than devising clean energy systems for the world, to replace fossil fuel globally and to bring local benefits to the billion whose health is jeopardized by smoky stoves burning wood or dung. Of course, the unique difficulty of motivating efforts to cut CO2 is that the impact of any action not only lies decades ahead, but is globally diffused. In contrast, for most politicians, the immediate trumps the long term, the local trumps the global. So climate issues slip down the agenda. And here, incidentally, the great religious faiths can be our allies in raising public concern. The Pope's recent encyclical on environmental and climate was hugely welcome. The Catholic Church transcends normal political divides. There's no gainsaying its global reach, nor its durability and long-term vision, nor its focus on the world's poor. The Pope's message resonated in Latin America, Africa, and East Asia, even perhaps in this country. And I mention this because Professor Ram Ramanathan here, through his leading involvement with the Pontifical Academy, deserves huge credit as one of those who gave impetus and substance to this initiative with the Vatican, which I think was important in smoothing the path to the Paris Consensus. I'm now going to change gear and talk about some concerns about novel technologies which will change society and empower individuals, but which will have a dark side too. Our world increasingly depends on elaborate networks, electricity power grids, air traffic control, international finance, globally dispersed manufacturing, and so forth. But unless these networks are highly resilient, their benefits could be outweighed by catastrophic, albeit rare, breakdowns. Real-world analogues of what happened in 2008 to the financial system. Our cities would be paralysed without electric power. Supermarket shelves would be empty within days if supply chains were disrupted. Air travel can spread a pandemic worldwide within days, causing the gravest havoc in the shambolic megacities of the developing world. And social media can spread panic and rumour literally at the speed of light. So to guard against the downsides of such an interconnected world plainly requires international collaboration. For instance, whether or not a pandemic gets global grip may hinge on how quickly a Vietnamese poultry farmer can report any strange sickness. So we need to think internationally. Advances in microbiology, diagnostics, vaccines, and antibiotics offer prospects of containing pandemics. But that same research, which is advancing very fast, has controversial aspects. For instance, in 2012, a group in Wisconsin and in Holland showed that it was surprisingly easy to make the influenza virus more virulent or more transmissible. the motivation was that by staying one step ahead of natural mutations, you can understand the virus better. But to some, this was a scary portent of things to come and a risky project in itself. To the extent that in 2014, the US federal government decided to cease funding these so-called gain-of-function experiments. And the new CRISPR technique for gene editing is hugely promising. But here again, there are ethical concerns raised by the Chinese experiments on human embryos and also by the unintended long-term consequences of gene drive programs. Back in the early days of DNA research, a group of biologists met famously in Asilomar and agreed guidelines on what experiments should be done and what shouldn't be done. And this seemingly encouraging precedent has triggered in the last year several meetings to discuss these exciting recent developments in the same spirit. Notably, there was a big inter-academy gathering in Washington last month. But today, 40 years after Asilomar, the research community is far more broadly international and far more influenced by commercial pressures than it was then. So I frankly worry that whatever regulations are recommended and imposed on prudential grounds or ethical grounds can't be enforced worldwide any more than the drug laws can or the tax laws. So I fear that whatever can be done will be done by someone somewhere. And this is a nightmare. Biotech involves small-scale dual-use equipment. Indeed, biohacking is burgeoning even as a hobby and competitive game. And technical expertise doesn't guarantee balanced rationality. The global village will have its village idiots, but they now have global range. And the rising empowerment of tech-savvy groups or even individuals by bio and cyber technology will pose an intractable challenge to governments and aggravate the tension between freedom, privacy, and security. Concerns about bio-error and bio-terror are relatively near-term, within 10 or 15 years. What about 2050 and beyond? The smartphone, the web, and their ancillaries would have seemed magic even 20 years ago. So looking several decades ahead, we must keep our minds open, or at least ajar, to transformational advances that may now seem more like science fiction. On the bio front, the great physicist Freeman Dyson conjectures a time when children will be able to design and create new organisms, just as routinely as his generation played with chemistry sets. I guess this is comfortably beyond the SF fringe, but were even part of this scenario to come about, our ecology and even our species surely wouldn't survive long unscathed. And what about another transformative technology, robotics and artificial intelligence, AI? It's 20 years since IBM's Deep Blue computer beat Kasparov, the world chess champion. And more recently, another IBM computer won a TV game show. Not one of the mindless kind featuring bubble-headed celebs. Winning that will be a doddle, but one called Jeopardy that requires wide knowledge and crossword clue type questions. Computers are advancing fast. They use brute force methods, of course. They learn to identify dogs, cats, and human faces by crunching through millions of images. Not the way babies learn. They learn to translate by reading millions of pages of, for example, multilingual European Union documents. They never get bored. And there's been exciting advances in what's called generalized machine intelligence. DeepMind, a small London company, now bought up by Google, created a machine that could figure out the rules of all the old Atari computer games without being told, and then play them better than humans. But advances are patchy. Robots are still clumsier than a child in moving pieces on a real chessboard. They can't tie your shoelaces, or cut your toenails. But sensor technology, speech recognition, information searches, and so forth are advancing apace. And they won't just take over manual work. Indeed, plumbing and gardening will be among the hardest jobs to automate. But they will take over routine legal work, conveyancing and such like, medical diagnostics, and parts of surgery. Can robots cope with emergencies? For instance, if an obstruction suddenly appears on a crowded highway, can Google's driverless car discriminate whether it's a paper bag, a dog, or a child? The likely answer is that its judgment will never be perfect, but will be better than the average driver. Machine errors will occur, but not as often as human errors. When accidents do occur, they will create a legal minefield. Who should be held responsible? The driver, the owner, or the designer? And, of course, the big social and economic question raised by all this is the question of whether the so-called second machine age is going to be like earlier disruptive technologies, the car, for instance, and create as many jobs as it destroys. Or is it really different this time? Well, the money earned by the robots will certainly generate huge wealth for an elite. And many argue that this will require massive redistribution of wealth to ensure that everyone else has at least a living wage and to create and upgrade jobs where the human element is crucial and is now undervalued. Carers for young and old, custodians, gardeners in public parks and the like. But that's a political decision for the future. But it's not that far in the future. But let me now look still further ahead. If robots could observe and interpret their environment as adeptly as we do, then they'd truly be perceived as intelligent beings, to which or to whom we can relate, at least to some extent, as we do to other people, and to which we might perhaps feel obligations as we do to other people. Such machines now pervade popular culture in movies like Her, Transcendence, and Ex Machina. So what if a machine developed a mind of its own? Would it stay docile, or would it go rogue? If it could infiltrate the internet and the internet of things, it could manipulate the rest of the world. It may have goals utterly orthogonal to human wishes, or even treat humans as an encumbrance. Well, some AI pundits take all this seriously, and they think the field already needs guidelines, just as biotech does, to avoid getting to this dangerous situation. But there are others who regard these concerns as premature and think that for a foreseeable future, we will need to worry far more about natural stupidity than about artificial intelligence. But be that as it may, it's likely that society will be transformed by autonomous robots, even though the jury's out on whether they will be idiot savants or display superhuman capabilities. There's disagreement also, incidentally, about the route towards human-level intelligence. Some think we should emulate nature and reverse-engineer the human brain. Others say that's as misguided as designing flying machines by copying how birds flap their wings. And philosophers, of course, debate whether consciousness is special to the wet organic brains of humans, apes, and dogs, so that robots, even if their intellect seems superhuman, may still be zombies lacking self-awareness or inner life. Ray Kurzweil, now working at Google, argues that once machines have surpassed human capabilities, they could themselves design and assemble a new generation of even more powerful ones, an intelligence explosion. He thinks that humans could transcend biology by merging with computers. In old-style spiritualist parlance, they would go over to the other side. Kurzweil is the most prominent proponent of this so-called singularity. But he's worried that it may not happen in his lifetime. So he's one of those who wants his body frozen until this nirvana is reached. I was once interviewed by a group of cryonic enthusiasts a Californian group called the Society for the Abolition of Involuntary Death. And they encourage you to freeze your body so that when immortality is on offer, you can be resurrected and your brain downloaded. And incidentally, if you can't afford the full whack, there's a cut price option where you just have your head frozen. And there are 200 or 300 people who have paid for this. I told this organization that I would rather end my days in an English churchyard than a California refrigerator. And they derided me as a deathist, a very old-fashioned person. But of course, research on aging is being seriously prioritized. Will the benefits be just incremental, or is aging a disease that can be cured? Dramatic life extension would plainly be a real wild card in population projections with huge social ramifications. But it may happen along with other kinds of human enhancement. And now a digression into my special interest, space. Because this is certainly an arena where robots surely have a future. During this century, the whole solar system would be explored by flotillas of miniaturized probes, far more advanced than those that have gone already. And they've done wonderful things. The Cassini probe flew within 30 miles of the surface of Enceladus, one of the moons of Saturn, here it is, to see if there was any water coming out in the hot flares. And NASA's New Horizons transmitted back these pictures of Pluto. Remember, Pluto is 10,000 times further away than the moon, and it sent back these pictures. And ESA's Rosetta followed the track of this comet and landed a small probe on its surface here. But all these instruments were designed 15 years ago. Think how much your mobile phones have changed in 15 years, and think, therefore, how much better we could do today in all these technologies. And later this century, giant robotic fabricators may build huge lightweight structures floating in space. Gossamer-thin radio reflectors, solar energy collectors, and such like, using raw materials mined from the moon or from asteroids. But what about the case for humans? You've got to be middle-aged to remember when men walked on the moon. And I treasure this picture signed for me a few years ago by seven of the Apollo astronauts. Incidentally, Neil Armstrong didn't sign, but I did once meet him. In fact, I once gave a lecture where he was sitting in the front row, taking notes, it seemed, or maybe doing the crossword, I don't know. But this was a meeting at the American Philosophical Society. It was a great honor to have him there, obviously. The question is, what is the future? Will people follow then back to the moon rather than just go round and round the Earth in low Earth orbit, as many hundreds of people have done, mainly in the International Space Station? Well, I think robotic advances have eroded the practical case for sending humans into space. Robots are getting far more adept. Nonetheless, I hope that people will follow the robots, though it will be as risk-seeking adventurers, not for practical goals. Indeed, the most promising developments are spearheaded by private companies. SpaceX, led by Elon Musk, has launched unmanned payloads and docked with the space station. And just last month, it achieved a soft recovery of the rocket's first stage, rendering it reusable. Amazing technology. It landed softly on its end. And Elon hopes soon to offer orbital flights to paying customers. And wealthy adventurers are already signing up for a week-long trip round the far side of the moon, voyaging further from Earth than anyone's been before, but avoiding the challenge of a lunar landing and takeoff. I'm told they've sold a ticket for the second flight, but not the first flight. And Dennis Tito may not be crazy in planning to send people to Mars and back, again without landing. This would involve 500 days in isolated confinement. And the ideal crew there would be a stable, middle-aged couple, old enough to be relaxed about a high radiation dose and happy to be cooped up together. Well, we should surely acclaim these private enterprise efforts in space, because they can tolerate higher risks than a Western government could impose on publicly funded civilians, and thereby cut costs compared to NASA or ESA. Remember, the shuttle failed twice in 140 or so launches. Each of those failures was a big national trauma. But test pilots and adventurers are happy to take much higher risks than that. So these manned exploits should be promoted as adventures or extreme sports. The phrase space tourism should be avoided because it lulls people into unrealistic confidence. So I think that by 2100, courageous pioneers in the mould of, say, Felix Baumgartner, the guy who broke the sound barrier in free fall from a high-altitude balloon, people like that may have established bases independent of the Earth, on Mars or maybe on asteroids. And Musk himself says he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact. And he's, I think, 44 years old, so he may make it. But don't expect mass emigration from Earth, because nowhere in our solar system offers an environment even as clement as the Antarctic or the top of Everest. It's a dangerous delusion to think that space offers an escape from Earth's problems. There's no planet B. Space is an inherently hostile environment for humans. For that reason, even though we may wish to regulate genetic and cyborg technology on Earth, we should surely wish these space pioneers good luck in using all its resources to adapt themselves and their progeny to alien conditions. And this might be the first step towards divergence into a new species, the beginning of the post-human era. And it would also, of course, ensure that advanced life would survive, even if the worst conceivable catastrophe befell our planet. And within a few centuries, I think we'll have these independent colonies who will be almost a new species. But what about the still remoter future? The stupendous time spans of the evolutionary past are now, of course, part of common culture, outside fundamentalist circles in, I guess, Kentucky and Kansas and places like that. But most people still tend to regard humans as a culmination of the evolutionary tree. And that hardly seems credible to an astronomer. Our sun formed 4.5 billion years ago, but it's got billions more years before the fuel runs out. And the expanding universe will continue, perhaps forever. To quote Woody Allen, eternity is very long, especially towards the end. The timescales for developing human-level AI may be decades, or it may be centuries. But be that as it may, it's but an instant compared to the cosmic future stretching ahead, and indeed far shorter than the timescales of the Darwinian selection that led to humanity's emergence. There must be some chemical and metabolic limits to the size and processing power of wet organic brains. Maybe we're close to those already. But fewer limits constrain electronic computers, still less perhaps quantum computers. For these, the potential for further development over the next billion years could be as dramatic as the evolution from Precambrian organisms to humans. So by any definition of thinking, the amount and intensity that's done by organic human-type brains will be utterly swamped by the future cogitations of AI. Moreover, the Earth's environment may suit us, we organics as it were, but it's not optimal for advanced AI. Interplanetary and interstellar space may be the preferred arena, where robotic fabricators will have the grandest scope for construction and where non-biological brains may develop powers and a level of scientific achievement that humans can't even imagine. This scenario suggests to me, incidentally, that if SETI searches were ever to detect some signal that was manifestly artificial, and none of us is holding our breaths for that, it would most likely come from some free-floating inorganic brain rather than from a civilization on an Earth-like planet. So even in this concertinaed timeline, extending billions of years into the future as well as into the past, I want to end up by returning back, by noting that this century, even in this time span of 100 million centuries, may be a rather defining era. It may be the century where humans jumpstart the transition to electronic and potentially immortal entities that eventually spread their influence far beyond the Earth and far transcend our limitations. That's the optimistic view. Or to take a darker view, it could be the century where our follies could foreclose this immense future potential. The stakes are very high. So let's now focus back closer to the here and now. One lesson I'd draw from the issues I've raised today is this. We fret unduly about small risks. Air crashes, carcinogens in food, low radiation doses, etc. But we're in denial about some newly emergent threats, which may seem improbable, but whose consequences could be globally devastating. Some of these are environmental, others are the potential downsides of novel technologies. We mustn't forget an important maxim: the unfamiliar is not the same as the improbable. These near existential threats surely deserve expert analysis to assess what can be dismissed firmly as science fiction and which could conceivably become real, and to consider how to enhance resilience against the more credible ones and to warn against technologies that are running out of control. And to this end, as Charlie mentioned in his introduction, we founded in Cambridge a group with just such aims, and there are a few other similar initiatives around the world. But the stakes are so high that even if these groups can reduce the probability of catastrophe by one part in 1,000, they'll have more than earned their keep. Well, this is billed as a lecture on science in the public interest, Bill Nirenberg's lifetime mission. So how should scientists concerned about these issues gain traction with policymakers? Obviously, dialogue with politicians can help. But scientists who have served as government advisors often find that they've had frustratingly little traction. Politicians are, however, influenced by their inbox and by the press. So experts can sometimes achieve more as scientific citizens and activists via books that get widely read, via campaigning groups, or via blogging and journalism. They have, I think, an obligation to engage because so many of these key issues have a scientific dimension. But, and this is equally important, they must accept that on the economic, social, and ethical aspects of any policy, they speak as citizens and not as experts. If scientists' voices are echoed and amplified by a wide public and by the media, then long-term global causes will rise on the political agenda. And Ram Ramanathan's interaction with the Vatican, which I mentioned earlier, was an effective instance of this. And those based in universities have a special privilege of influencing successive generations of students from many nationalities. And I know that's taken very seriously here at UCSD. So what should be our message to them? It's surely that there's no scientific impediment to achieving a sustainable world where all enjoy a lifestyle better than those in the West do today. We live under the shadow of new risks, but these can be minimized by a culture of responsible innovation, especially in fields like biotech and AI and geoengineering, and also by reprioritizing the thrust of the world's technological effort. So we can be technological optimists, but the intractable politics and sociology engenders pessimism. The scenarios I've described, environmental degradation, unchecked climate change and unintended consequences of advanced technology, could trigger serious, even catastrophic setbacks to our society. But they have to be tackled internationally, and as an institutional failure to plan long-term and to plan globally. Spaceship Earth is hurtling through the void. Its passengers are anxious and fractious. Their life support system is vulnerable to disruption and breakdowns. But there is too little planning, too little horizon scanning, too little awareness of long-term risks. And it would surely be shameful if we persisted in unsustainable policies which bequeath to future generations of our students a depleted and hazardous world. Wise choices will require the effective advocacy of natural scientists, environmentalists, social scientists and humanists, all guided by the knowledge the 21st century science can offer and inspired by values which science alone can't provide. So I finish with my favourite quote from the great immunologist Peter Medawar. I quote, "The bells that toll for mankind are like the bells of alpine cattle. They are attached to our own necks, and it must be our fault if they don't make a tuneful and melodious sound." Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.